Good afternoon. Our next speaker, I'm proud to say, is Ted Lee. Ted grew up in Charleston, and in 1999, he received an MFA in fiction writing from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And for those of you who know fiction writing programs, it's the best in the land. And he didn't ask me to say that. I said that. He wrote part of this, but I wrote that. It's a wonderful place, and I look forward to hearing what Ted's doing, which is working on a novel. And when he's not working on a novel, he writes about food and travel for, among other publications, Gourmet, New York Times. The earlier discussion of, do I give this away or do you? Okay. The earlier discussion Mr. Blunt had of lard and the article in the New York Times was penned by this gentleman and his brother. So it's a small world we live in. When he's not doing that, he works in the daily business assisting his brother Matthew at the Lee Brothers Boiled Peanut Company and Boiled Peanut Catalog in Charleston, South Carolina. Ted Lee.
Thank you, John. Thank you all for coming or staying. my food and wine editor called me the day before I left New York, and he didn't know I was presenting, and he said, "Oh, you're going to the Southern Foodways. It was great last year. I'm crushed." He couldn't come this year. And he said, "I'm crushed. I can't go. But man, you're going to have fun. I mean, that's a real group of scholars. They really know their stuff." And I'm thinking, you're not telling me what I want to know. So I went. So I had actually done a lot of research before I talked to him. I hadn't done a lot of research before I wrote the title for this presentation, so I'm going to apologize for the title for three reasons. First, it's not so exciting. I'm actually amazed that there are as many of you here that are here. And secondly, because it misrepresents the history of the peanut. And thirdly, what was my third thing? Oh, the third thing is that it really doesn't speak to the message of this particular symposium, which is Southern food en route, traveling on. And I definitely want to speak to that because I think I have a few credentials in that regard. Let me tell you how I got into food. I mean, other than having grown up in Charleston, South Carolina, and learning to cook from my parents. In 1994, in February of 1994, it was a really cold winter in New York. I'd graduated from college in 1993, and I was really miserable, and I was working in publishing, and I was terribly homesick. And I thought, I'm going to bring boiled peanuts to New York. And this was 1994. Krispy Kremes were not yet in New York. So, I mean, I thought, it was with my brother who couldn't be here, unfortunately, but I don't know how we'd both do this at the same time. So anyhow, there were no Krispy Kremes in New York. There were a ton of Southern restaurants, and we thought, this is easy. Boiled peanuts are delicious. It's going to happen. And so we went to the Hunts Point Terminal Market in the Bronx to get a 50-pound bag of, I think they were sun-dried Valencias from New Mexico, and we brought them back to our apartment and boiled them up and bagged them in very cool-looking silver Mylar bags, sort of like a Ziploc thing. Had a great-looking label with actually a picture of a peanut, which was hand-illustrated, but it's not unlike the one that's on the front of your hand out there. And we went to all the Southern restaurants in New York, of which there were many, the Chat and Chew, the Brothers Barbecue. Their names are eluding me now, but I think we went to Jezebel, the one that Roy Blunt was talking about. And a footnote, Jezebel is good, but be prepared to pay about $60 a person. So back to the original discussion, going to the Southern restaurants with our cool-looking bags of boiled peanuts, and you'd go into the door. You know, we'd go in the sort of 11 o'clock in the morning because that's the best time to catch a restaurant owner. And we'd say, "Can I speak to the owner?" And they'd say, "Sure." And the owner would would come out and he'd say, I wonder if I can do the accent right. I can't, because I'm, but he'd say, you know, hey, how's it going? And we'd be like, well, you know, how cool, you're running a southern restaurant in New York. We've got some boiled peanuts. We're wondering if you'd try them on the bar. We'll just give them to you. And, you know, we just want to create this buzz here. We want to sell it as, like, a trend. This is going to be a fad. And they would say, well, I'm from Long Island. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think I want that. And then you'd say, well, here, look at it. And you can imagine. And to try to get them to taste it was, you know, a third step. It wasn't successful at all, except that we did go to a place called Cafe Bila, owned by Alexander Smalls, who's an amazing individual and was really inspiring. He was the one guy who was running a southern restaurant in New York who said, boiled peanuts, thank God, you know. And he said, yeah, I'm going to put them on my bar and see what happens. Nothing happened. He had the same hard time that we had trying to sell them and his crowd was sophisticated. There were probably a lot of people from the South too. I mean, Bula was great, and I was very sorry when it closed. It was a fantastic restaurant. But he didn't have any success, and neither did we. And about the same time, my brother and I hosted a high school reunion for all our friends who were living in New York, and they said, well, of course boiled peanuts aren't going to sell in New York, but why don't you sell them mail order? Because if you did, I'd buy them. And so we did, you know, that was, okay, we'll change. We'll become a mail order business. And we hand-delivered some boiled peanuts to Florence Fabricant with a press release saying who we were and whatever else. And, you know, this is all shoestrings here. I mean, we were looking in the phone book, Florence Fabricant. Okay, she lives on West End Avenue or wherever it was. Truck up there on the subway, bag of boiled peanuts. And, you know, 2 weeks later in the food notes of the New York Times, it says, you know, here they are, they're available, here's these guys' phone number. And we got 100 calls in the first day, all from expatriate Southerners. And so we did realize that there was a customer base out there. But more than that, we realized that the customer base knew exactly what they wanted. I mean, out of those 100 calls, we must have had 10 people that said, I'm from Gaffney, but I hate boiled peanuts, but I do like Duke's mayonnaise, and I can't get it, and I really want it. Can you get it for me? And so we said, yeah, sure. And then, you know, my brother had to get in the car and drive down I-95 to Charleston because we had to get some Duke's mayonnaise. So, you know, the business built really upon our customers' goodwill and sharing with us the information, you know, like they wanted the fig preserves that their grandmother made, the kind that were whole figs, not cut up, with paper-thin lemon slices and crystallized ginger. And that's how we built the business. And we now have about 40 products. They're all pretty authentic stuff, pickled ramps, stone ground grits. We carry boiled peanuts three ways. And that was another story. We started with fresh boiled peanuts only, shipping them fresh by FedEx. You know, talk about costing a lot of money. If you think a $2.50 bag of white lily is expensive, try 5 pounds of boiled peanuts, which is our minimum order, FedExed to Alaska. You're looking at paying, you know, literally $12 a pound for boiled peanuts. And we do have customers in Alaska, and they're not rich, and they will pay that. So it just goes to show how, you know, you move out of the South, but those ties really are there. And, you know, food, you know, I sometimes feel guilty about charging what we charge, but then again, I'm not making any money at it. It's more of a hobby, so I don't feel terrible about it. Anyhow, I'm sort of gotten off message. This is all to tell you that I do actually have some credentials about speaking about this, because we do have a customer base of tens of thousands of expatriate Southerners. And they're great, and, you know, I should be paying them for calling me on the phone and talking to me 30 minutes about, you know, how their grandmother made stuff, how they make stuff, how the traditions are passed on. The other credential I have, which is more recent, is that I've been writing about food for magazines and for newspapers, the large story. And my brother and I try to find topics that are not being covered and that we think are being overlooked for whatever reason. You know, it's why we wrote about corncob wine for Gourmet, why we wrote about Northern Florida for Food and Wine, because we just felt that that a lot of places have a very rigid notion of what Southern cooking is, and that there's a simplicity and an elegance in home cooking, sort of like what Natalie was saying. It really is all based in the home. And to get that material, you have to go to Southern homes. And it's tough. You do have to make compromises sometimes. I made a number of compromises in the lard article because I don't think you should get supermarket lard. I think you should get it from a butcher, or you should render it yourself. And if you can't, don't get it, because it will have been sitting on the shelf for 3 months and it's going to be, you know, rancid despite all the BHT and whatever else is whipped into it. So it's sort of, you know, every time we bring a Southern story to a national audience, we're essentially participating in the theme of this symposium, and there are a ton of issues and compromises that go along with that. I guess that's it for my credentials. I'm sorry I talked about myself so much. I'll move on to the peanut, which is quite a fascinating legume. Everyone here, of course, I'm probably throughout this presentation, I'm going to be telling you a lot of stuff you probably already know, but there may be some people in the room who are not familiar with this material. So everyone should know that a peanut is not a nut. It's a legume. It comes from the family Leguminosae, which is where all peas and beans come from. And that's why a raw peanut has a very green flavor that surprises most people who taste a raw peanut for the first time. It tastes a lot like, it has that same green flavor as a bean, just, you know, a runner bean, just bite into it, that green vegetal flavor. It's sort of unique in that popularly it's considered a nut, and yet it's a legume. It's also curious because within the family Leguminosae, it's only one of 700 genotypes in the family that grows its fruit underground. So here's this vine, a flowering vine, that sends up a flower. And when the flower dies, the end of that stem gets fertilized, and it goes back towards the ground, it drives into the earth, and a peanut develops underground. So you all know this, right? But what's interesting is that the Linnaean classification, Arachis hypogea, Arachis meaning spider, for the spidery, it sends all these flower things out, sort of like in, you probably see in your illustration, it looks sort of webby. Hypogea means he who sticks his head in the ground, and that's, I think, a good metaphor for the peanut in sort of in society. It is this bizarre thing that's not quite a nut. It's a pea, and there, you know, we talk about people who are associated with peanuts, like, I'm forgetting his name, but the Italian gentleman who founded Planters and George Washington Carver as being wizards, and I don't think it's unrelated to its peculiar botany. I mean, it just happens to be a very strange plant. I'm way off in my notes here, so I'm just going to have to... Statistics on the peanut. Well, here's another thing about peanuts, is that when they're pulled out of the ground, they grow underground in these clumps. And they're machine harvested in the USA, so a machine rolls through and picks up these things and turns them upside down, and they're They're dried out in the sun for about 3 days because they have 30 to 50% moisture in them. And that moisture's got to come down to 10% within a very short time, or else they're going to develop aflatoxin and go bad. And so it's like this odd thing where a raw peanut is not quite roasted, but it is dried. But it's not dried enough to be parched or roasted like a nut. So there are all these stages of liminality. And a lot of times at the catalog, we'll get a call and say, I want your fresh green peanuts. And we can't supply fresh green peanuts because fresh green peanuts are only in season. I mean, if you really want green boiled peanuts, you got to pull them up out of the ground. You got to go to a pot and put them in, or else they're not, you know, they really rot easily. And we can't do that. The only green peanuts we provide are in a can. And you know, the people who make that just have a way to preserve it somehow. But it's a very perishable product. Very perishable product. I'm going to get on to the. I don't know. See, my Food and Wine editor said that you all were scholars, and so I Xeroxed all this stuff that... So you see the illustrations, which I swear to you, the originals were better. Well, let me just do a brief geographical chronology of the peanut. The reason why we know what we do about peanuts is thanks to pottery. Pottery was found in the graves of the ancient Peruvians around 2500 BC. And it was pottery that was both, the peanuts were both peanuts themselves preserved in pottery, and also the pottery itself had representations of them. And that was, you know, in the period 2500 to 1000 BC is when those civilizations found that sort of pottery. As agriculture got more advanced and people, or at least this theorist said, as people, you know, were able to irrigate and spend less time in the fields, pottery got more representational. And that's why in 500 AD you have this page, which is two vessels, one of which is a peanut vendor, which I think is fantastic just from a personal standpoint, but also... just because it is so clearly a thing of peanuts. It actually came from a set. I didn't have enough room to put the other set, but this is a set of vessels of market figures. And there was, you know, the tubers vendor, the manioc vendor, every other thing that, you know, was basically available at that time was represented in this. I got this out of a book of arts in Peru, because I figured, you know, if there really were peanuts around then, they would have represented them, and I was sort of thrilled to find this. This is also a water vessel with representations of a peanut, but I was just amazed at just how much that's exactly like, you know, what we know of as a peanut. It's so ancient. The geography... is roughly this. I'm going very quickly here, obviously. The Spaniards arrived on the Peruvian shore in 1532, and they take the peanut back to Spain, obviously, and then into Central Europe, and possibly to the Philippines. The Portuguese, when they land in Brazil in 1500 and make the entire thing into a sugar plantation, also managed to take the peanut back to Portugal, to both coasts of Africa, and they're also very involved in the spice trade at this point. So they also take it to, that's where this thing over in the Indian Ocean, where it actually goes from the port of Aden. They had a fortress and a spice factory in the port of Aden, you know, where the boat, where the recent tragedy happened. They had fortresses all along the Malabar coast, which is this coast of India. And they also had a fortress and factory in China. And so, I mean, it was sort of immediate. After peanuts had existed, you know, in ancient Peru, they spread up to Mexico by the time of the conquistadors. They'd spread, I mean, they basically were in all of Latin America, Central and South America. And obviously, since they took them to Africa, they were in Africa. And they actually only came to North America in 1619 on the slave ships, obviously. And they were, I've read sort of different accounts of how they came over on the slave ships, but some say that one was a sort of breathless account about how peanuts were very much beloved by Africans, which is true. I mean, there are a lot of African recipes. In Jessica's book, there's a wonderful recipe for a peanut and chicken stew, which is called chop. She's told me the name of it last night, Mafé. Thank you. So I read a breathless account about how peanuts were wonderful. They sustained the slaves on the journey over. I've also heard that they were the only form of sustenance given to slaves on the ships over to America. So there's definitely some disagreement on that point. So they come to North America in 1619, and they're grown on plantations for slaves. And I'm told that Plantation Kitchen did not use peanuts at all, which is true, but they did ultimately catch on. And I found out in early American recipe books, they do make their way into plantation kitchens. And lost my page of notes on it, of course. Bear with me here. So the peanuts are in America, but they're only being consumed by slaves, the rural poor, and they're used as hog feed. And in 1783, in Jefferson's Notes on Virginia, he reports little commercial importance of peanuts. They're only grown as herbs in people's gardens, which, of course, was not true. But the early Americans did not take to the peanut right away, and it's the first reference to peanuts I found in a cookbook was in 1828 in the Virginia Housewife, despite that Virginia was the center of peanut production in the U.S. at the time. In the Virginia Housewife or the Methodical Cook, the Mrs. Mary Rudolph book, 1828, there's no reference to peanut. Ditto in the Southern Gardener and Receipt book, the Phineas Thornton book from Camden, South Carolina. He was a grocer in Camden, and he doesn't have any reference to peanut, too, which is interesting because he was a middle-class man in Camden, South Carolina. He wasn't a plantation owner. He ran a store and wrote a wonderful cookbook, but no reference to peanuts. It's in 1847 in The Carolina Housewife by a Lady of Charleston. It's the Sarah Rutledge book. There are several recipes for peanuts or ground nuts, as they called them then. There's a ground nut cake. Made with parched pounded nuts, brown sugar, and egg whites. And there's also a ground nut cheesecake, which I thought was pretty amazing. It was very surprising to me to find that out that in the Confederate Receipt Book, which is, of course, the 100 recipes published in 1863 about, you know, by the Confederates, about living in a position of poverty and deprivation, that there is no recipe for peanuts in that book, which is odd because we hear the popular myth, and it is true, is that Confederate soldiers were the original white Americans to take to the peanut in full force, and it was the soldiers who got them, and it was Union soldiers who actually also took to them and took them north when the war was over. They were also Confederate troop rations. At points of deep deprivation. So the rest of peanut history, which I'm going to pass over as quickly as I'm doing everything else, is P.T. Barnum introducing them to New York City in 1870. And between the years of 1865, after Appomattox, the Union soldiers take them north, and 1870, peanut production in the U.S. Increases 200%. So they're really catching on. They're being brought north. Baseball is just coming, into real popular prominence, as are circuses. And so by the early 20th century, they're pretty much everywhere. Another great figure of course, in the earliest 20th century history of the peanut is George Washington Carver. And it was interesting, in researching this paper, I read two biographies and then a book of Carver's own words. And the biographies sort of go back and forth over whether he was really a folk hero who brought all these great methods to rural farmers, uses for the peanut and whatnot, and over whether he, took or whether he was sort of the dupe of the peanut industry, and that, he provided all this free marketing to an industry that really wasn't, it wasn't about the little man, it wasn't about the poor rural farmer. But what I found that most incredible was George Washington Carver's own speeches and words, and his speech to the House Ways and Means Committee in 1921, when he was proposing that they impose a tariff on imported peanuts, peanuts being imported into the U.S. from India and China and elsewhere, so that American farmers could start growing peanuts. Why are they underselling us in this time? It's post World War I. It's just before the Depression, and it's really amazing his enthusiasm for the peanut and his creativity. He comes to the House Ways and Means Committee, and it is not an accommodating bunch. They give him 10 minutes. He has a box of materials and products to show them. They give him 10 minutes, and they're a pretty vicious crowd. They make jokes. They make racist jokes. And his responses are so seductive that it completely silences everyone. And not only does he speak for his 10 minutes, they extend that because the things that he's making, peanut milk, peanut cheese, punches, just everything. And that's just to name the food things. That's not even talking about the ink and the feed, and he's doing things with flour. And it's just a really creative energy that clearly the House Ways and Means Committee needs and is desperate for. And they let him go on for another 10 minutes. And then they basically just say, you can have as much time as you want. And it's just this, it really makes, it makes you tingle, because it's just the sort of energy that, that energy when you're going to the kitchen and you sort of have had these cuckoo ideas, and maybe your siblings have been giving you hell about them. No, but really, I've decided I think I'm going to read that speech whenever I go to the kitchen, because it's just a super... show of force of like what a creative spirit can do in the kitchen. It can do in the kitchen. It's very infectious. So to a forum like this, I would definitely recommend the book, which is The Words of George Washington Carver. I'm not quite sure who edited it, but it's fabulous. I think I'm probably going to end my history there, because it's not... I think I was doing better with stories about the business. I'm just trying to make sure that I don't leave anything out, which is interesting. Oh, there's an interesting illustration in there of a peanut vendor in 1890 wearing a suit of peanuts. And it's too bad it didn't reproduce better, because they are real peanuts, and it's unfortunate. But this figure of the peanut vendor in history is a very strong one, and you see pictures of, by the early 1910s in New York, you had pushcarts selling roasted peanuts, and there are wonderful illustrations of that. And I remember, I grew up in Charleston, in downtown Charleston, and I remember a peanut vendor who pushed a four-wheeled sort of English perambulator through the streets of Charleston with small bags of brown paper bags of peanuts. So I'm sort of crazy about that image of the peanut vendor throughout history. What's interesting, though, is that groundnut cakes, which I mentioned were found in Sarah Rutledge's book, which basically molasses and peanuts, sort of a precursor to peanut brittle, were also sold on the streets of Charleston, I think in other cities too. And when you see the groundnut cake vendor, when I see photos of it, it's always a woman. But the peanut vendor... I'm just making this, I'm just throwing it out there. Maybe it is a gendered thing. It's interesting to me because boiled peanuts are so clearly a very personal thing. I bet there are tons of you in this room who born and raised in the South, and just don't like boiled peanuts. Are there any? Raise your hands. Don't be shy. John Edgerton. All right. Oh, man. I can't wait to tell my brother. So I wanted to get more to issues sort of related to business. Being a business that is dedicated to providing quality products, that takes from, takes from its customers really good advice, like the woman who called us 3 years ago and said, you know, you have fig preserves, you have pumpkin chip preserves, you have iced tomato pickle, you have Jerusalem artichoke pickle, and you don't have pickled peaches, you're nothing. And so we said, work with us, you know, come on. And so she said, you know, these are the way I make them. Or no, she didn't make them. She, you know, lived in New York and was a publishing executive or something. She didn't want to touch them. She wanted someone else to make them for her, but she wanted them to be made, you know, the way her mother made them, her grandmother. And so we got some recipes together, and we talked to the woman who makes our preserves. And, you know, she said, yeah, I can do 600 jars for you, no problem. And so trying to be, you know, a serious purveyor of authentic Southern foods, and at the same time recognizing, and this is going to play to some issues that came up in the last, in the panel discussion, all of a sudden a food that was so elegant and so simple has now become a luxury item, a super luxury item. I want to sort of share with you the rundown of the expense that a recent customer went through to get boiled peanuts. It wasn't pickled peaches, but our quart jar of pickled peaches is, I don't have the catalog with me, but I think it's like $16.95. And then you add on top of that shipping, and you're talking about a very expensive peach. So a guy named Neil Jordan recently is a guy in Alaska. He's not very wealthy, I can tell, because he wanted me to save him $3 on shipping. He wanted his peanuts two ways. He wanted the 5-pound pack fresh. He wanted a case of 24 cans of rotten berries. That's the green peanuts in a can. And the case of 24 cans runs him $39.95. And the shipping to Alaska is $39.95. And on the fresh boiled peanuts, he's paying $22.50 for the $5 bag. And they're being FedExed. So the FedEx is costing $29. And this is someone who I can't ask my customers these sorts of personal questions, but he did have me send the peanuts by priority mail rather than UPS because I was saving him $3. And, you know, here he is paying $100-some for peanuts. And I said, Neil, let me work with you. I sell raw peanuts. I can ship you these raw peanuts. They're not perishable. They're sun-dried Valencias, which is mostly what's sold in Charleston these days, is sun-dried Valencias sold year-round. I can send you these raw peanuts. I'm charging the earth for them so that I can stay in business. And I said, you know, I send you these raw peanuts. They come with the recipe. You boil them up. They gain twice their weight in cooking. So I send you 2 pounds. You've got 4. Let me send you 10 pounds. It's only $40. It's not heavy. I can ship it UPS. And he's like, I don't cook peanuts. So it is a bizarre position to be in, to be enthusiastic about authentic foods, to be unironic about authentic Southern foods, because there are a ton of people, there have been some recent food trends in America, like, or in New York City especially, like Krispy Kreme donuts, or a food trend that's not Southern is an example that's very similar to the boiled peanut. It's the Japanese boiled soybeans. Now, Japanese boiled soybeans, called edamame, in sushi restaurants, they're very similar to the boiled peanut. It's just a boiled soybean. And you know, you pay $5.95 for a little bowl of them at a sushi restaurant. But they did become so popular that, you know, now you can get them in the freezer case at any corner store in Manhattan, and they're not so expensive and whatnot. And when that happened, it was about 2 years ago. I think it's, you know, sort of like, I think it's odd to say it, but I think it's fashion people who pick up on it. And it's, you know, since they're people who eat like birds, it is sort of like donuts and edamame. So edamame is getting all this press. I'm getting hundreds of phone calls from all my friends saying, I just had edamame in a restaurant and I've got a really great idea. You're going to market your boiled peanuts as redneck edamame. I will never market my peanuts as redneck edamame. Mark my words. No, but it, you know, I guess I'm reiterating the same thing, which is we're all talking about how great authentic Southern food is and how it's home-based. And yet it somehow has become a luxury item. And it brings up a lot of different issues when you go to write about them, because my problem when I write about things is that an editor, or in one case, I do field segments on regional food for a show on the TV Food Network called In Food Today, and they'll say, we want some raw material, you know, we really want to go to Charleston, and we want, you know, take us where you really go, you know. And so I'll say, great, I have a list of 5 locations, and let's go. And we'll go off to, Marvin's Meats in Harleywood, South Carolina. It's an old Southern butcher where you take your hogs to him, and he kills it and, you know, gives it back to you so you can smoke it. And so we go with the crew, and we're there, and we're imposing upon Frank Marvin, who's a businessman. He has a great business. You know, we stay there, take up all his time, and I'm doing my little thing with his liver pudding for the camera, and he's shooting me, and he's like, you know, the producer's, who's a guy from New York who confesses, you know, the first thing he says to everyone we meet is, I know nothing about food. And so we're doing the segment inside the store, and the producer says, you know what, Frank, come here. I want you to have, like, your people in the back, like, doing what they're doing in the background. And he says, sure, yeah, I can do that for you. And so we start filming the segment, and so his people come in with, you know, a pig cut down the middle. And the guy throws it down on the table. And in the meantime, you know, I'm saying something on the camera about this liver pudding is the best. And they throw it down on the table, and with a hacksaw, he's going. And the producer says, whoa, wait a second here, cut. And I'm saying, wait, this is what you asked for. And he's like, oh, yeah, I wanted it raw, but, you know, I was thinking maybe, like, you know, like an RC Cola sign with, like, bullet holes in it or something. You know, give me some material here. And I'm thinking, no, this is the material. What are you looking for? You know, and so I mean, I hate to bring up these things because it sounds like we're all talking about as though we're all food writers. And I know some of us aren't. But I think you probably encounter that any time you encounter someone who says, oh, you grew up in the South. Tell me what that's like. And you just want to say, you know, do you have 20 years? Because we can go through it all. I mean, we can go through every little part of it. There was another story along those lines I wanted to tell, along the same theme. A magazine, a Condé Nast magazine that's not a food magazine, wanted to write about boiled peanuts. You know, they wanted raw material. And so I sent them boiled peanuts, and they did the photo shoot, and the woman called me up last Friday and said, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but it looks like a bucket of turds. And I want to say, I don't take it the wrong way. I mean, there is no wrong way to take it. It just means something different to me than it does to you. We're different.
I'm wondering if I'm leaving anything out here. Maybe I'll just open the floor for questions, because I think, the things I'm talking to are coming from a very narrow experience of, a narrow experience of life and this sort of corner, and I'm sure the issues that I bring up touch on many of the things that you all do. I'd love to hear about that. I'd love, let's this guy at Food and Wine, Pete Wells, he's a great guy. He referred to it as a battleground last year, so let's get an old battleground going. Yeah, Lynn wanted to know how much of the catalog is, how much we manufacture ourselves and how much we buy. And the answer is we manufacture nothing. We're just food brokers. We love authentic Southern foods. And we happen to be in a position to, we have suppliers and we're on great terms with them. And so, I'm basically just a middleman, which is why I got into food writing. It is because, I have this business, it rolls along, it's really nice. I've got, between 12 and 15,000 customers. They know what they want. They know what I can provide. And it's sort of a no-brainer. It doesn't take all of my time, which is why I write about food. Yes, sir. Well, actually, the business is based in Charleston, and I spend about half the year there and half the year in New York. I live in Harlem in New York, and I just want to point out something ironic about that. My next-door neighbor in Charleston is a guy from New Jersey who's never cooked in his life, and my next-door neighbor in Charleston, in Harlem, is from Dillon, South Carolina, and every Sunday she cooks salmon patties and collard greens and grits. I mean, there's irony for you. I mean, there's the New South and there's the Old South. It's just switched. Yes, sir.
One more question that's we're running a little
behind. Yes, sir.
Other than like moles and pipians, what did you find in South America Spanish?
That's a good question. He was saying other than moles and pipians, what else in South American cuisine uses peanuts. And I have to confess, I don't know. I mean, I think that when the Spanish came and settled in Peru and, basically destroyed the Incas, not only did they do that and then take their peanuts and take them all over the world, but they also wrote in their chronicles that the Incan food was very coarse. It was boiled this and boiled that. But to speak to your question, I'm not so familiar with Latin American cuisine, except I did make a mole for that lard story. Raw peanuts deep fried in lard. You can't make a mole without lard, in my view. That's it. John tells me that's it.